Welcome everybody to the last day of this telesummit called It's About How You Live, taking the fear out of conversations about advanced care planning, serious illness, caregiving, and end-of-life care. This last day of the telesummit is me. You're going to be hearing from me. And I have a really special person interviewing me today, and that would be my son, Alex. So welcome, Alex.
Thank you.
I'm just really excited to have brought you these 21 fabulous experts. And then I'm going to take today as an opportunity to share with you a little bit about my experiences working in hospice care. And so I'm really just going to kind of turn it over to Alex at this point. Take it away.
Hi, everyone. Tina Ketchy Stearns, my mom, has worked in hospice for over 12 years, educating medical professionals as well as the community at large. About end-of-life care, palliative care, advanced care planning, caregiving, and grief. She's produced this free telesummit called It's About How You Live, Taking the Fear Out of Having Conversations About Advanced Care Planning, Serious Illness, and End-of-Life Care. The telesummit launches September 15th, featuring 21 experts in these related fields. You can also go to www.itsabouthowyoulive.com to gain access to this free telesummit at any time. Tina's also designated a six-week webinar training program surrounding these topics that will be available later this fall for both medical professionals, caregivers, and anyone really who's interested in these topics. Prior to joining hospice, she worked in the travel industry for over 20 years. She has an MBA from Wake Forest University, and in addition to her six-week training program, she's also the director of provider and community outreach for Hospice and Palliative Care Center in Winston-Salem. So really my first question would be, could you just please share one or more of your personal stories about the losses you've had in your life?
I'll be happy to. So I've actually had four losses, my parents and then one set of grandparents, my father's parents, because I really never knew my mother's parents. Her dad died when she was 8 years old and her mother died when she was 17. So I really only had one set of grandparents. And my grandfather was the first one to pass away in the late 70s. He had bladder cancer, which was kind of hard to detect back then. And by the time they did find out about it, it had gone to several other parts of his body. And he actually died in the hospital. I remember I was in college, and I remember it was a very sort of cold, upsetting situation in that we couldn't be with him. They let my grandmother's room, but the old star room, sort of blaring light, uncomfortable furniture to sit in. And we knew he died when we could hear my grandmother crying quite loudly. And then she came out of the room. So it just was a hard, I just didn't feel like I could be with him. And that was really hard. Then my grandmother died in, Alex, you were 3 years old, so it must have been in 1997. Mm-hmm. And she was in hospice care. That's the first experience I had with hospice. And she was in her own home. They cared for her in her own home. And I wasn't there. We didn't get there until the day before she died. So a couple of days before she died, my mother and sister were with her, and they said that we called her Ketchy. My maiden name is Ketchy, and we called my grandmother Ketchy. I don't know why, we just did. I always kind of thought that was sort of cool. So they said that Ketchy started talking about this gorgeous house that they were building, and she just wished they would hurry. And she had a beautiful end-of-life experience. My mother and I were actually in the home when she died. We weren't in her bedroom where she was. We were actually out in the kitchen chatting, and every now and again would go back and check on her. And I went back and she had died. So I hate that I wasn't right there holding her hand when she took her last breath. I do take comfort in thinking that she probably could hear mother and I talking, and she knew she was in her home and she knew we were near her. And I just remember the hospice nurse that came in after she died, because you have to go through all the medications and, you know, dispose of all that. And she was just so kind and loving and compassionate and just handled the whole situation as almost as if she was a family member. I mean, it was a really, like I said, it was my first hospice experience, and it was a beautiful experience. Very different from when my grandfather died. Then the next loss was my dad. He died in 2001. He was diagnosed with lung cancer in 2000, and he wanted to fight it, and he did chemo and radiation. And I remember sitting, all of us were talking with the oncologist, and after she described the treatment plan, I don't remember who asked the question. It may have been me, but one of us asked the question, so what are you hoping, like, what's the best we can hope for? And she kind of looked at us like, well, like we were kind of crazy. And she said, well, I'm expecting this, it's going to go away. I mean, cancer is going to be gone. And I about fell on the floor. I had no idea that that was even a possibility because he had small lungs. He had small cell lung cancer, which is not operable. So the great news is his treatment started probably in the summer. And by Christmas, he was in remission. The cancer was gone. And mother and daddy got to celebrate their 50th anniversary that January. And we were just all just over the moon. Well, later in January, he started not feeling well. And sure enough, it wasn't the cancer had come back. It was really the treatments had caused his lungs not to work right. They were not able to absorb oxygen and do what your lungs are supposed to do. He wound up in the hospital, and there were like four things wrong with him. And we had fixed this one, and then we fixed the second one, and then we addressed the third one. And there was just this one last thing that we had to fix, and then he was going to be good to go. I was so focused on that one last thing, because we've already fixed these other three things. Now we just got this one last thing to fix. What I didn't get is that that one thing wasn't going to get fixed. It was not going to get fixed. And I just didn't understand that. So he wound up on a ventilator after a biopsy to figure out exactly what was going on with his lungs. And that's when they determined, yep, it was really kind of, I don't know if it was one too many chemos, one too many radiations, whatever it was the side effects from the treatments had rendered his lungs to not be able to do their job. So he wound up on a ventilator, and my sister and I were with him when he died. He was taken off the ventilator. He actually lived for many hours after he came off the ventilator, and the nurses really weren't expecting that. So that was hard, because then I had some regrets about, I wish I'd told him things that I hadn't told him, because I kept thinking, we beat cancer, you know, We got these three things taken care of, and now there's this fourth, and then we're good. And I just didn't get that he was not going to fix that fourth thing. So I do wish I had said things and done things that I just thought I would have time to do, and I didn't. So that was really hard. Then my mother had COPD. And by this time, I was working with hospice. And then I got it. You know, I got it. So the wonderful thing about my mother is that she was able to have palliative care the first two years. So they came in and helped her with her COPD symptoms, because there's no cure for COPD. And then she was in hospice care for 4.5 months. And I tell this story every day when I'm out teaching medical professionals in the community and whoever I'm in front of, that that whole it's about how you live thing. So you can see, I've got that ribbon up on my wall right there. It's the National Hospice ribbon. It says it's about how you live, because the hospice providers will tell you, we're not helping people die. We're helping people live until they die. And that's very different, but that's what hospice is about making the most out of every single day you have. And so about a month and a half before my mother died, she said she wanted to go to the beach, because she wanted to drink tequila sunrise on the beach at sunset. And that's what we did, two nights in a row. So she had wonderful hospice care. I remember when she first came under hospice care, and I brought in the CNA that was going to give her baths, because happily she'd finally admitted to us that she was not feeling comfortable in her shower by herself. She was afraid she'd fall. And I was just so happy that she shared that with us. So I brought in Tandra, who was actually the manager of the CNAs at the time. And when I brought her in, just introduce her, there wasn't going to be a bath that day, just to say hello. Mother was sitting in the chair, kind of all blown up like a boy. You know, she wasn't real sure she was happy about this. And they met and chatted for a little bit. And 2 weeks after Tandra started caring for my mother said she wanted to marry Tandra. And I said, well, Mother, Tandra's already married. That's not going to happen. Long story short is that she was in our care for 4.5 months, and she had a beautiful experience. We all had a beautiful experience. We all knew what was coming. We all had lots of time to say what we wanted to say. I was with her the night before she died, and her feet were getting dry, and we put lotion on it and all that kind of thing. But she asked me to put rubbing alcohol on her feet. And I said, well, Mother, you know, your feet are already dry. That's just going to make them even more dry. And she said, I don't care. Put rubbing alcohol on my feet. So the last night that she lived, I'm at the foot of the bed with cotton balls soaked in rubbing alcohol, rubbing them on the soles, the bottom of her feet, because that's what she wanted. So those were my four end of life experiences, 2 in the hospital, 2 in hospice care. And I can tell you, Daddy did it exactly how he wanted to do it. Now, he wanted to fight it, and that was exactly what he wanted to do, which is great. We all need to have our hands on the steering wheel and do this thing the way we want to do it. I will say that the 2 hospice experiences were far and away much more, it just made the time with these people so much more special, memorable, beautiful, and I just, I thank my stars every day for being a part of an organization like hospice.
Well, thank you very much for sharing that. And I remember both your parents passing and what that was like for the family. And I didn't see a lot of what happened actually behind the scenes. So a lot of what you just said is news to me. One thing you said I found interesting was a lot of people do believe that hospice care is about just death and dying. The concept that it's about how you live might be surprising to some people. So in 12 plus years working in hospice care, what are some of the common myths or misunderstandings a lot of people have about hospice?
Exactly what you just said, Alex. Everybody thinks it's death and dying. Everybody thinks it's the last few days or weeks. The hospice benefit through Medicare and Medicaid is a 6-month benefit, meaning if you have a diagnosis, if you have a prognosis of 6 months or less till end of life and you're no longer seeking curative treatment, you are eligible for hospice. If the person is still with us after 6 months, which happens often and we're thrilled about that, as long as the doctor continues to guesstimate that end of life is likely within 6 months, it just rolls forward. And every provider will tell you their crystal ball is very foggy. You know, nobody really knows, but when their best educated guess is 6 months or less prognosis, then you're eligible for hospice. And the number one thing our families say is they wish they called sooner. And getting back to the myths, one of them is a lot of people think hospice is just one big, huge umbrella under which a lot of locations are around the country. The analogy I like to use is the faith community. So all churches are in the faith community, but they're all separate and independent, and that's how hospices are. So there's about 4,300 hospices in the United States, and there are hospices, you know, in other countries as well. In fact, it started in England in 1964. But lots of different models. There are a lot of for-profit hospices. The one I work for is a not-for-profit, but there are a lot of for-profit hospices. They're just different models. I'm not saying one's any better than the other. I have to say I am proud that the hospice I'm associated with is a United Way agency and a not-for-profit. Another myth is that hospice is a place that you go. So the hospice I work for, we actually have 2 inpatient facilities, but not all hospices have an inpatient facility. They can contract with a hospital or with a long-term care facility to provide a higher level of care should that be needed. But it's not a place. The 80% of us say we want to die at home, which your grandmother died at home, your great-grandmother died at home. 80% of us say we want to die at home. So the number one thing hospices do is provide care in the home. You don't have to go anywhere. Wild horses, we're not going to take my mother out of her house. I can assure you of that. Another myth is that it's either too expensive or that it's free. I'll tell you that 92% of hospice patients, this is the statistic from the hospice I work for, but probably pretty true across the country. 92% of our patients are either Medicare or Medicaid. So Medicare is 65 or older or disabled for 2 years, and Medicaid is when there's a financial need. People apply for Medicaid. So that's 92% of our patients fall under one of those two programs. That's your tax dollars at work, okay? You've worked your whole life. Your hospice care is already paid for. I don't qualify for either Medicare or Medicaid quite yet, but I have private insurance, and most private insurances have a hospice benefit. If I were homeless living under a bridge, since I work for a not-for-profit, we can't do what we do without donations. And one of the things our donations provide is care for people that can't afford it. They don't have any money. They don't have any insurance. They don't have two nickels to rub together. Well, that person living under the bridge is going to get the same level of care that anybody else is going to get. So the big, I think, takeaway is that no one has ever denied access to hospice care due to inability to pay. Some other kind of myths and misunderstandings is that, I think we already covered this, but I just want to put a period on this, is that it's only for 2 weeks or it's just for the last few days of life. And I really need people to understand, we call it the surprise question. If you asked your doctor, would you be surprised if Mrs. Smith was here this time next year? If that doctor says, yeah, I'd be surprised, it's probably time to call for a hospice assessment. It is probably time to call for a hospice assessment. And if they're not quite ready or qualified for hospice care yet, they very likely could qualify for palliative care. So palliative care, that root word palliate means to ease. So just like with my mother with COPD, she had palliative care to manage her symptoms 2 years before she qualified for hospice when they decided, I think we're in that 6 month or less window. So don't wait. And again, the number one thing our families say is they wish they'd call sooner. So I think those are some of the major misconceptions about hospice.
I understand. And so within the organization of itself, I understand that there are 4 levels of hospice care. Can you describe those for your viewers?
Sure. So talked about a couple of them already. So one of them is providing care in the home. Secondly, is that inpatient type of care when there's kind of a higher acute situation going on. So for example, if we're caring for your loved one in the home and X out of my email. So sorry. I didn't, all kinds of noises going on in the background. Care in the home, number one thing that we do. Secondly, let's say we're caring for the loved one in the home, but something out of control happens, whether it's out of control, vomiting or pain or whatever it is, it's beyond what the family can deal with. That's when having an inpatient facility is great. So they get around the clock care, things get stable, the person goes right back home. Sometimes people will die in the hospice home, and that's perfectly fine. I think most hospice homes across the country are made to look as homey as they possibly can. So there's that level of care. There's a third level of care called continuous care. And this is the same scenario, caring for the loved one at home, something kind of out of control happens, but this is the patient, just like your grandmother, Alex, that never wanted to leave her house. So this is when a nurse can come into the home and instead of just for a routine visit, they stay continuously, that's why it's called continuous care, until things stabilize. And it's reevaluated every 24 hours to make sure they still meet that heightened skilled need. When they stabilize, things just revert back to the visits. Often what's going on is this person is actively dying. And so for that patient that never wanted to leave their home, we sort of feel like that's our best last gift we can give that patient. And then the last level of care is called respite. Now, this is when the patient's feeling good, doing good, they're rocking and rolling, they're good, but the caregiver is about to fall on the floor. As we've talked about in a lot of these interviews through this telesummit, caregiving is exhausting. And it really isn't uncommon, especially with an elderly couple, that the caregiver will fall ill simply from the caregiving responsibilities. They're so strenuous and stressful and just a lot. So respite care is when, even though the patient's feeling good and doing good, they can go to a hospice home for 5 days simply to give the caregiver a break. And a lot of people don't realize hospice provides respite care.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So for this telesummit, you've interviewed 21 experts in the field of hospice care, palliative care, advanced care planning, caregiving, and grief. You're interviewing the last one in the series. So now that the telesummit is complete, what are you hoping your viewers will take away from watching the telesummit?
The name of this summit is, it's about how you live, taking the fear out of having conversations about advanced care planning, serious illness, and end-of-life care. I feel like we have well over exceeded achieving the goal through all of these interviews, helping people understand it's okay to talk about it. Your loved one's probably anxious to talk about it. The medical providers want you to bring it up. This is a team thing, and it's really important that everybody knows, hopefully well in advance of the crisis, because then, you know, there is no fighting. There are no wringing of hands and guessing and after the loss, guilt, feeling like, did I really do the right thing? Is that what they would have wanted? Hopefully you're going to do this well in advance of a crisis or the unexpected. But if you're sitting in the middle of a crisis in a terminal diagnosis, we really want you, all of these 21 experts, including myself, want you to embrace these conversations and allow them to happen so that you can actually have a deeper, richer, more intimate relationship with your loved one, because that is what will happen. You will come to know them, know their values, know what they want, know what they don't want. And as soon as you understand your loved one's wishes, then you need to share what your wishes are. You need to talk about what you want and what you don't want and how long you want it and when you don't want it anymore. These are conversations that it's a two-way street and it's not a one and done because things change. Maybe the person that you designated as your healthcare power of attorney moves to England. And that's okay. They could still be your healthcare power of attorney. I kind of agree with one of the experts that was interviewed in the series that it's kind of nice if it's somebody that's relatively local that can go see the doctor, be there, you know, physically be there. That's preferable. Doesn't have to be that way, but it's preferable. But anyway, you could change your mind. I mean, you could decide right now, I'm going to fight. And then another 30 years, maybe you don't want to fight. And maybe you're really okay with not going through a whole lot of treatments. So what I really want everybody to take away and what I'm so grateful to these 21 experts for sharing their knowledge and their wisdom and their advice, and a lot of them shared free gifts even, is, you know, embrace these conversations, have them now. Don't wait till Thanksgiving. Don't wait till, you know, something happens. Have them now. Start having them now. Because none of us are promised tomorrow, and take it as an opportunity to just grow and strengthen your bond with your loved ones and get to know them more intimately than you do already. That's my hope and prayer.
And your bio mentioned a 6-week training program. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Right. I've put together a 6-week training program in you'll hear all about it. I'll send you some information about it another time. But the first week is going to be about hospice care and palliative care and end-of-life care. The second week is going to be about advanced care planning, where we're going to walk through the Living Will and Healthcare Power of Attorney document line by line. The third week is caregiving, and there's going to be a special emphasis on Alzheimer's because that's such a growing, important, and heartbreaking topic that a lot of people are dealing with. The fourth week will be on grief and bereavement. The fifth week is on community resources like hospices, like long-term care facilities, and understanding the different skill levels of long-term care facilities, cancer services, just different resources in your community that are there to help and support you. And then the sixth week will be reviewing the major talking points, as well as additional helpful resources that can help you that we hadn't already covered in the first 5 weeks. So you'll hear more about that.
Okay. And thank you for sharing all of this with me. Are there any last comments you'd like to make before closing out the telesummit?
Well, I will say, and I'll try not to cry, I love having you interview me. So proud of you. And these are important conversations that we have had, will continue to have through the years. And I think the thing that is spinning around in my head while I'm kind of stumbling over my words right now is we were talking about your great-grandmother, and you were three when she died. And I don't know if you remember the cane that we sawed off so that you could play with it. And as a result of that, I collect canes now. I have a whole collection of canes, and it started with us taking Ketchy's cane and cutting off part of it so you could play with it. Do you remember that?
I think I do, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So I really think my parting words will be for just congratulating everybody that is tuned into this telesummit. Find me on Facebook. Find me on my website. It's abouthowyoulive.com. Share with me your takeaways from this telesummit, the things that really spoke to you. Are there topics that you'd like to hear more about in the future? But I really just want to say congratulations and thank you for finding the time to watch these interviews, take away the lessons that were generously offered to you. If you didn't have time to see each and every interview, they're on my YouTube channel forevermore. So just at your leisure, go watch the interviews that you missed. Each and every one is just well worth your time. So I just really want to say thank you so much for being a part of this and for learning. And I guess the last thing would be, you know, share this telesummit with family and friends that maybe weren't aware of it, because we all learn from each other. We all learn from sharing our experiences, and it's been a true honor. It's been a true honor, and I want to say a huge thank you to all the experts that were a part of this as well. So, any last comments you would like to make, Alex?
One question that I had that I forgot to ask before. I know that it's never too early to start having these conversations, but for say people in more, in my age range who might not be thinking about these things, what are some early steps younger people can take to make sure that they are not at the 11th hour later in life, wishing that they had started preparing sooner?
That is a fabulous question. So you're 23. Anybody 18 years or older should have advanced directives, and those are a living will and healthcare power of attorney. Oftentimes, the young folks can talk about these things better than the older folks can. So if you and your family have not had these discussions, and you are a millennial or just a younger person, why don't you bring it up at dinner tonight or tomorrow and say, you know, I heard this really interesting interview, and I don't think we've ever talked about this, and I kind of don't want to talk about going on a ventilator when I really have to go on a ventilator. I'd rather talk about it when I really don't have to go on a ventilator. So can we talk about this stuff? I mean, you guys are very powerful. And, you know, I've said in a couple of these interviews that I'm a boomer, I'm a baby boomer, and we're now called the silver tsunami because there's so many of us, 10,000 of us turn 65 every single day. So there's going to be a lot of these end-of-life conversations happening over the next 20 and 30 years simply because the age of our country, the demographics of our country. So, Alex, for somebody in your age group, I think you just need to embrace how important this is, maybe even embrace that opportunity to connect in a tighter, richer way with your loved ones by having these conversations. And a lot of people out there know the case called, this woman's name was Terry Schiavo. This was probably getting on 10 years ago now, but it may be even more. She was 29 years old and had a stroke. You're 23. You know, she was 29 years old, had a stroke, had told her husband she never wanted to be on life support. She did not tell her parents that. They kept her on life support for 15 years while they fought in a courtroom about whether she should come off of that ventilator or not. So illnesses can happen to anybody of any age. Accidents can happen to anybody of any age. It is not too soon. I don't care if you're 23 or 18 or whatever you are. It is not too soon to start having these conversations. And thank you for asking that question, because that's a great question.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And we might have something to talk about over at dinner tonight.
You might. Yes, we might. Thank you for saying that, because, right, you don't have your documents done yet, and we probably need to kind of jump on that. So, well, again, I want to thank you, Alex, for being my interviewer. You did a great job. I really appreciate it. And once again, thank you to all the viewers that have been a part of this telesummit. Thank you to the speakers, the experts that are just an amazing, distinguished group of people. And remember, this telesummit is going to be available to you to watch anytime, forevermore. So take advantage of this free gift, and everybody just do what you need to do to get your head in the right place, to take the fear out of having these important conversations and embrace them so that you can have a deeper, richer, more intimate relationship with your loved ones. So thank you so much, everybody. Until next time.